Welcome to Nothing Ventured, a podcast exploring some of the lesser heard stories in tech and venture. Join me, Arish Shah, as I speak to founders, investors, and ecosystem operators to bring you insights from the roads less traveled. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today, we're going to be talking to Jelaine Chan, who has had an incredible wealth of experience, starting off at Microsoft within operations, going on to Microsoft Ventures, and now supporting startups and scale-ups with everything to do with people ops. It's such a pleasure to have you here with us today, Jelaine. How are you going?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's going to be a good one.
Absolutely. I'm very much looking forward to it. I mean, the first thing I have to kind of get into with you is on your LinkedIn profile, you have an operating manual. What's that about?
So I work with people on projects. So a lot of the time I'm bringing people together for very specific projects and then sending them on their way. So there's a couple of, I always get this wrong, but a couple of bases of forming, storming, norming kind of thing about teams. And the thing I noticed the most is people generally politely don't ask others how they want to be treated. So we call it the platinum rule. So in scripture or whatever, it often says treat people as they wish to be treated. For me, it's treat people as they wish to be treated, not how you wish to be treated. And so in that, how do you know how people wish to be treated? You have to explicitly ask them. And for some reason, that's not the thing we come up with in conversation. So I've got an unusual name, and even just the fact that my name is barely pronounceable with how it's spelt, people struggle to ask me, have I got your name right? Am I saying it right, over and over again? Because when we first meet, that question is asked. But over time, it's assumed that you know how to pronounce my name, and you might have met me once for 10 minutes. But people feel uncomfortable asking me, oh, I've forgotten how to pronounce your name. Could you remind me? And so it's that kind of concept. I was thinking, why do we not ask people, how do you work? What do you like? Because the one thing we don't like to do is piss people off. But the one thing we don't ask them is, what pisses you off? So at the start of my user manual, I was raised with sarcasm and humour. And the challenge with that is, if I feel an affinity to someone and I feel like they're firm friends very early on, I default to humour and sarcasm. A lot of people find that insulting and think I'm being really rude. And so it's easy then for me to kind of say, look, sarcasm is the language I use that shows that I think we get on. And it allows people to understand it's not personal. This is how I am. And so then I come across people who have them. There's a loads of sort of different formats. But it just stops people having to kind of ask the question, how do you work? What's going to piss you off? How am I going to frustrate you? What would you prefer me not to do so much of? I think it's really clear to understand, certainly when you're in a leadership position, it is not an instruction to say, this is how you must act with me. As leaders, I get my team to write an instruction manual or an operations manual or a user manual or whatever they call it. And I default, I go where they are. So as far as I possibly can in a leadership role, I defer to how my team would prefer to work. They don't have to defer to me. And that's really clear. It's not a directive. It's not a you will get on if you treat me this way. But I think it gives people a real structure to understand if I do this, she's probably not going to be as friendly as if I do it a different way, or I'm going to get a better result if I do it this way versus that way. And it kind of gives people a bit of an ease. Mine's extremely explicit. It's very open and transparent. You can actually keep it quite simple. So it doesn't have to be kind of all your dirty laundry out there. But I find a lot of people, when they read it, they understand me quite closely. You can tell people who are in your tribe because they go, oh, lots of these things resonated with me. And generally, the people that have said that to me are firm friends. And it just gives people an understanding of how best to work together. If they're coming in a virtual way to work together and then go away, you don't have that chance to get to know people over 6 months, a year, 2 years, which is where we learn some of this stuff. You come together for 6 weeks, 6 months, and then you go again. This gives them shorthand to just get up to speed as quickly as possible so that they can get to know people quickly and get into the deeper conversations that people have when they trust each other.
I mean, that's incredible. It's very, very much similar to, I guess, companies' culture manual or, you know, the sort of playbooks that you get in scaling businesses, because it's really difficult at those very early stages to understand, as you say, how to interact with someone. Everything that the one thing I took from that is that we must be firm friends, because you are quite quite significantly sarcastic with me when we speak. So I take that as a massive compliment. No, but I think it is really important, because we do forget, especially within technology, we forget that at the heart of technology sit people, and people need rules and boundaries as to how they work together. If we just sort of had a free-for-all, I guess it would be very difficult. And I have come across in businesses and operations I've worked with where people are a little bit uncomfortable because of the style of leadership or the style of management within their team may not kind of resonate or may not gel with the way that they would like to be treated. And that often leads to, I guess, you know, people moving on, which is hugely costly for an organization, and, you know, the cost of recruiting someone new, et cetera, can all compound. But yeah, no, look, I think that's really, really cool. So where could people learn how to write one of these operating or user manuals? It'd be great to figure out if there was a framework to be able to do that.
So I use a basic framework. I believe somewhere in my LinkedIn posts, there is one on how to build your own. The head of Shopify has one. He calls his the blueprint. There's a couple of product managers. I'm going to say Zhao. I can't remember her first name. She has one as well. She used to be a product manager, I think, at Facebook or something like that. So you can look it up, and there are quite a few in there. I think the main things I think about or I ask when I'm working with people is what form of communication they prefer. So for me, it's text-based generally, or face-to-face phone call that is planned in. And then there's things that what frustrates you are the big ones. What pisses you off? What would you sack someone over? What frustrates you? That goes very deeply into the value base of someone, and also allows you to understand that if someone acts a certain way, you're immediately going to react in a kind of childish kind of way that feeds back. So you won't even put a mature kind of 10-second rule on it. You just, as soon as it frustrates you, it's gonna trigger you. So those
lizard brain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think the other thing is, I noticed going through, I mean, I've been doing this now 15 years, probably. I had a version of it when I first was a people manager. I realized that some of the behaviors that either trigger me are behaviors that I have that I hate or I don't like in others. So that's an interesting thing. So sometimes look at people around you that behave in a way that you really dislike, and then reflect back and go, actually, you probably do that yourself. It's an interesting paradox often, I think. And also your upbringing, your family, people around you who do certain things, you just go, I really love it because they know you so well. I really love it when they do it that way. And it's a life's work. I mean, obviously we're not final. I update mine probably twice a year, just because people say things, or I read it and go, yep, that's still true. I always review it. And sometimes it's just a kind of, you know, your value base, what you prefer, what you don't like, anything can go in it. But just people can get to know you quickly. I think one of the major ones for me is I'm not really a popular culture person. If I go to the hairdressers or whatever and they say, oh, you know, if you watch Strictly or Pop Idol or whatever these things are, these newfangled that kids are watching, I don't get involved in that. But if someone says to me, what was the last book you read, or you know, would you recommend any books? Because I'm an avid reader, that will start a conversation with me. And sometimes all you need is how to start a conversation with me. What will get me talking? The one that will not get me talking is, what is it that you do, which is my bugbear. So on a theme is how can people start a conversation with me, I think is the most important one, because that's really where relationships start.
And that's really interesting. And something you just said there resonated hugely. So I remember sitting around a table with a bunch of people who called themselves Linky Brains at the time. It was a whole thing a couple of years ago. We should chat about that another time. And I remember going around the table and everyone was introducing themselves, and everyone introduced themselves by nature of what they do. I am a sales person, or I'm a marketing manager, or I'm an investor, or I'm a whatever. And I just remember kind of when it came around to me saying something along the lines of, okay, well, what I do is not who I am. And then kind of expanding a little bit on that. And I think it's a really important thing, again, coming back to that theme of people, to understand who the person is, not what they do. Moving on to sort of more business themes, right? So you've had this incredible journey from a huge organization like Microsoft, and now supporting startups, scale-ups on their journeys. those are really hard circles to square often, right? And often we find that people coming out of larger organizations actually fail within startups because they don't have that agility. They don't necessarily have the kind of frameworks to be able to operate in the levels of uncertainty that you see in a startup on a scale up. Equally, within startups and within scale-ups, there are huge differences in terms of potentially how you organize yourselves, right? So take us through the journey, I guess, to start with, and then how do you circle that square between agility and process by making sure that, you know, as a startup, you need to be nimble, but equally, as you scale, you need processes and structure in place to be able to do things. What is it that helps you do that? And what are the kind of themes that you put in place to make sure that businesses can scale?
Oh, there's loads to unpack there. So I think the main thing to say about Microsoft is I started there, what essentially was an incubated organization. So before Microsoft did a lot of buyouts and M&A, they would take seasoned leaders and go, here's some budget, go and build a new business organization. And so I was part of that. So we were converting our phone-based support into an on-site support service for our big customers, which were governments, big banks. They were paying lots of money. And essentially what I did was there were three of us, 10 engineers across Europe, Middle East and Africa, and we would get the problems in from the customers. We'd identify the right engineer and send them out on site. It was fortunate in that sense, in that because we were this incubated business, it was kind of like special projects of the CTO, for want of a better kind of description. So I could shoot, I think it was like my hierarchy was four people and I'd get to Bill Gates. So on the outside, it looked like I was kind of quite important, even though I was just some temp running around. So people would do things for me just because I asked, and I just went and did what I needed to do. That was a successful business. We went from reactive to a proactive business. So we'd start telling our customers how to use our services so that they didn't have all these breakages and best practice. So that when I left, we'd integrated into the established Microsoft business support infrastructure. There are 3,500 engineers globally. There are about 70 people doing what I once did. And I built the processes and helped build the digital tools to enable that to happen. And so a lot of the stuff I learned was kind of like startup. We had an office, we had the Microsoft infrastructure. I had to build my own machine. So someone gave me a Dell and went, here you go. So there wasn't this kind of corporate infrastructure. It was still very much running as we needed to, and we could do what we needed to do. Then I hit Microsoft culture because we integrated the business. That really was for me a massive baptism of fire. And culturally, it didn't fit for me. And I did struggle to find my place. But what I learned, A, from dealing with people multicultural is you can't live your life with stereotypes. So you have to meet people, and you may have these, you know, very limited stereotypes if we talk about how we learn at school, where these people come from. So you have to get to know people, and you have to, again, meet them where they are. Their language, English is their second language, all of these things that just make you understand that you can't just put people in boxes and assume they're a certain way. We had to work asynchronously. So I've been working remotely for the last 16, 17 years because I've worked globally. So for me, all of this stuff is not new. And obviously Microsoft build a lot of the products to enable that. And the other thing I learned was looking at people on a spreadsheet and then asking people to work in a way that, well, if we put these numbers here, then we can optimize these people here, is not the same thing. So as an example, to get across Belgium by car takes 2 hours, whether you're in Brussels or you're across country. So you can't do what looks like on a map a very easy task and then move on to another customer in a day, because half of your day is spent driving in between. So it's that kind of local knowledge or that on the ground knowledge that people are not your processes. People will only bend and break so far. They have families, they travel, they get tired, they're not robots, all of these things. So I understood very much that I built a lot of processes. And as we kind of know, engineers are quite open to telling you that there's a better way or that you're wrong. They don't mince their words in the most part. And so you have to, if you want them to do stuff, you have to do it and shape it around them largely. So that made me realize that you could do the McDonald's version, which is everything is such a small process that you just get a monkey to do it. No disrespect to the people that cook the food, but essentially they've got a very small thing that they're allowed to do, versus building processes that enable people to do a job very simply and then shine with the stuff that they are great at. So for me, in the most part, it's my team. What are they good at? Build the processes around them, but also the engineers. The engineer is there to fix a problem, not sit there putting data entry to say where they are and where they're going and do timesheets. And so it's kind of building processes that people follow. The other thing where the disconnect happens, I think there's a really good way, again, fortunate at Microsoft to be very agile, and we just were allowed to do what we needed to do for a very long time, which, you know, that freedom is very important. But also when you go into startups, when I first started working with startups, there was this whole, we're disrupting everything. But there's some things about human nature that they need. There's guardrails, there's boundaries. They just need to know that they can do what they like within a certain constraint. They need to know answers. And if you keep being the bottleneck, so if you're the CEO who doesn't document decision-making, for example, or, you know, even just let's take an expenses, you know, what is your expense approval limit? You're constantly asking the CEO what is ostensibly an admin question. That bottleneck is ridiculous. It's a waste of everybody's time. So delegation is important, but documenting or at least kind of giving boundaries to that delegation is really important. And I use a kind of analogy, I suppose, is trust but verify. So I'm a very trusting person, but if you break my trust, that's it. It's very hard to get it back. But what you do, certainly when I had to hire a lot of entry level people because I didn't have big budgets. A lot of the job I did, they kept trying to automate or offshore. And so I had small budgets and I used to hire people entry level. So they didn't know the job. They didn't come in qualified. And it wasn't really a job that you could say, oh, yeah, everyone's done this. But what you do is you give them what I call like a paving slab, and you say, within this paving slab, you can do these things. And then once you trust them that they can do those things, you give them maybe four paving slabs, and then you give them a bit of decking. And by the time, I mean, I had three or four people I would employ in a heartbeat, I would give them, you know, 6 acres of land, because I know that the boundaries they had, they would make good decisions in. And it's that trust but verify. But you need to do it in staged approaches. And you need to give people the safety that if they screw up, they're not making a massive mistake. And that all comes a little bit from structures and processes that are based around people. If you put process in and no one follows it, there's really no point in having the process there. So you have to have processes that that people follow. And they tend to have to be water. Humans are lazy. They will take the easiest path. If you get a team of people who are all doing a good job, take all these little magic things that they've learned to do to make their lives easier and bring them together, your process will work because it comes from the people that are doing the job. You're not the expert. They found little ways, but they haven't talked to each other to share those little ways. What you're doing is bringing together best practice, putting it in, saying this is the process you follow. When you bring it in to what they're already mostly doing, they'll do it. It's when you ask them to change and do something that they can't see the results of, that's where processes and structure, yeah, it just will not happen.
I think that goes against a lot of the thinking that I've certainly had in the past around early stage businesses, especially where you sort of think of processes and structures anathema. But actually what you're describing there is that processes and structures actually give you liberty rather than constraint. So you would advocate effectively for putting in these sort of processes and structures really from day one. Is that right? Like, it makes sense. Start small, as you say, with a paving slab and then grow that over time rather than waiting until you reach a critical point where you may actually be at risk of breaking and putting it in place there. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I think the first process I always, when I'm working with leaders, like partnerships, I suppose, or teams of co-founders, is actually worst case scenario processes. So the main one, I mean, it's like a prenup. You know, you don't expect divorce when you get married, but you should consider what you would do if you do. I think it's always like, what's the worst that can happen? Let's plan for it. And with founders, circumstances change, everything else. But what you can do is, in the cold light of day, we're all calm, we're all friends right now. How do we want this business to end? Because it will. Someone's going to get run over by a bus. You know, we all die. It's sad, but it's a definite death in taxes. So the first thing you do is you say, if one of us dies, how do we share the business? If there's three of us, two of us, whatever, does that go to my family? You know, there's some real legal stuff. Does it go to my family? So you end up, I know, business being owned by the mother-in-law or something really quite mad. And so that's the conversation. If I want to leave without hurting anyone, how do I leave? Can I just walk away? And how do the shares? And you do that when you're all lovely and friendly, because we know in business, A, life changes, you have kids, you get cancer, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But also, you know, we all change. We all have different lives. Our aspirations change. Things happen. And to think otherwise is, you know, naive. And so that structure is the first thing you do. And I recommend anyone who takes on founders or takes on their first few hires, that conversation is, what, how do the shares happen? How do we walk away? So that's very simple. And then it enables you to have conversations that have no emotion in them, because, again, difficult conversations tend to come out of emotional situations. So what you want to do is pre-plan the emotional situation and take as much emotion out of it. You can't remove it completely, but you can kind of go, this is our starting point, is what we agreed when we started. And then, again, it comes to, as you grow, if everything is in the CEO's head or the founder's head and every decision has to go through the CEO, you get decision fatigue. You get the, what was the latest thing I heard? What was the new and shiny? What sounds fun? What sounds exciting? Which is all lovely if you're the CEO, but it's not a way to run a sustainable business. So decision making, I think, is the next one. It's, how are we making decisions and how are we delegating and how do we build trust? How do I trust someone? What do they need to prove to me that I can trust them to go and do something that is ostensibly work with my baby? Because that's really, when you're founding a business, it's your baby, whichever way. You know, if you have a baby, then, you know, you're checking the childcare, you're making sure the nanny has qualifications, first aid, whatever. We don't do the same sometimes with our business. And it's kind of, I suppose, with any process, structure, whatever you want to call it, the question is, what do I do now and what do I do next? If people don't have answers to that, they have to keep going. What's next? It's draining as a leader to keep going. Oh, you don't want to micromanage people. You just want them to get on with stuff. And that enables that.
Yeah, again, I think a massively interesting point. Micromanagement is, especially to very senior people, or if not senior, certainly experienced people. And, you know, with most startups, you have some really, really quite high performance people. And I have seen in a lot of venture, I say a lot of ventures, I've seen in a bunch of ventures where founder or the CEO micromanages, and that can again be a real killer to not just productivity, but morale and culture, et cetera, et cetera. It actually becomes very, very painful because you want to just get out of their way and let them get on with what they're good at. But one of the things that I think I'd love to touch on as well, because, you know, you sort of brought it up to an extent around, you know, the founding team and how they work together. But a lot of that comes down to culture. A lot of that comes down to kind of how, again, how we as people operate within these ventures. And one of the problems that I think we face potentially is there isn't a lot of diversity of thought within ventures, because there's a lot of very similar people talking about very similar things. So where do you see the state of play as far as that's concerned? And how do we better enable, you know, not just diversity, but like an expansion of kind of the cultural way that we think about startups and scale ups in the ecosystem?
The famous culture fit question. So I suppose I'm probably going to quote, I think, Seth Godin, where culture is like people like us do things like this. So you find your tribe in that way. And I think there is, as probably most co-founders have attested to, there's often a two mates get together. They've got, you know, complementary skills. They go off and build a business. And so, and often they tend to, I mean, when I first kind of got into the startup ecosystem in London, a lot of these were young white men and generally privileged. They were able to go and say, I don't need a salary. To add to those dimensions, they hadn't really ever had a job. If they have, they were probably sacked. They've never been managed. And they're young enough that they've not had life situations like parents dying, having kids, and all of the other stuff that the majority of, you know, the population have. So you've got these brilliant ideas, creative, you know, free to do whatever they want. They go off and do some amazing things, but obviously they have to. I think one of the magic things is, oh, I want to hire people with entrepreneurial spirit, or, you know, it was on a job description for quite a while. It's like, I want a team of entrepreneurs. Like, you cannot manage entrepreneurs. They're all off on their own thing. So again, that kind of understanding makes all of that a challenge. That has changed, and I've certainly been aware of businesses you know, later stage people coming out, having some money, investing, all of that sort of stuff. So that landscape has changed. I think the age of founders is now changing and a lot of older people are doing it. So you have this challenge where you have a couple of mates who know someone and they bring together. And so essentially the early people in that business have a shorthand, have a language. I'm just thinking of my little brother has friends that he's known since birth and 5 years old, you know, he went to school with. And they call themselves stupid things, but they've got this shorthand that together they all know. And if they'd set up a business, they'd probably hire like them because it is easy. Everyone has the same frame of reference. Everyone uses the same language. You get a lot done because the shorthand is there. Brilliant. But you then get groupthink or what any other verse. You don't get diversity of thought. I think one, I'm obviously involved in a lot of women in technology type things. And one of them was, you know, if a woman had designed these phones, they wouldn't be black because they'll get lost in the bottom of a handbag. Simple things like that. Another example, I was in a diversity group. I remember this a lot, a diversity group at Microsoft. And one of the guys in the team had to have an Apple phone. He was probably the only person in the building that had an Apple phone because he was blind and he needed Siri. And he said this amazing thing is if you design, so essentially most technology is designed for very narrow, privileged, intelligent, probably male, almost definitely white. And it's a very small kind of chunk that they can get on with technology because it's designed for them. He says, if you design for the outliers of people who don't have, aren't fully abled and have different life experiences, you automatically include everyone else. And that's always stood with me. And I spoke to someone who worked for sort of Citizens Advice, and in the public sector, they have to think of those outliers as standard because they're dealing with the population. And so you just have this kind of thing where you just realize that very narrow focus means you miss other people's perspectives. You miss great product ideas. You miss all of this magic of different people's life experience and different people's perspective and all of those things that is what makes having a conversation with people that you don't know very well from all walks of life thoroughly entertaining, but also very difficult. And so I suppose it comes full circle. If everyone has a user manual and can shortcut that difficulty of, I don't understand your frame of reference because I don't live your life. And we all obviously, even if we look the same and sound the same, we still had a different upbringing. So we're all different. But often we don't think about the differences. What we do is we focus on the similarities. And I love to embrace the differences. I love to have difficult conversations with people with different views in a respectful way. But everyone gets heard and everyone gets their point across. We may not all decide the same thing, but it's just like bringing that common language in. Like you said about the culture documents and the playbooks. It's that common language as a business. This is how we are. And anyone who comes into it enhances our culture. They don't fit into it. They enhance it. Really difficult. I mean, this is not like, oh yeah, flippant comments. It's really hard to work in a diverse team. And I'm working with a client at the moment. The leadership team is male. No one at the mid-level is being hired that is female. And they say when we have a conversation with the leadership team, they almost don't know how to speak to us. Of course they don't. They don't speak to women on a regular basis in a business context. And so you kind of go, you have to practice those things. And it's a bizarre thing because you're thinking as a woman, I'm like, I'm not that different. But again, in the climate we're in, a lot of men are scared. What do I say? How do I, you know, there is real, and I'm scared if, you know, put my foot in it all the time of, you know, the wrong thing said to the wrong person. But you also say, you know, I'm trying in the language I understand to say this. If I offend you, I really apologize, but I can't articulate it any other way. Saying that often just brings down the barriers. And we have to not be scared about saying the wrong thing, but also in a way that is respectful. And so I might say the wrong thing here, but can you understand my perspective? And so, I mean, I was talking to a non-binary person. And I was like, I don't know how to say this and I don't want to offend you. He's like, it's fine. Say it and then we'll work out the language later. And if you say stuff like that, people, yeah, just understanding, compassion for them, compassion for yourself. Again, it's really not easy and it will make life difficult. But your business will be so much better as a result because you've got all these ideas and you're covering so many different risk factors. It just makes it better.
I think that's really poignant. The reality is that the more you include, the better you as a business are, because you are taking, not only taking in the perspectives, but you are seeing things in a way that you wouldn't have seen them otherwise. I mean, actually, you know, what you just mentioned about, or you mentioned earlier about the phone being black and being lost in a handbag, I certainly would never have thought about that 20 years ago. Today I carry a man bag, so maybe
I don't use handbags, so bit. I was like, oh, okay. So again, you know, different perspectives. It's interesting, isn't it?
For sure. So just as we wrap up, because I think we could probably go on for a long time and a lot of other topics, there are a couple of things I did want to touch on though. So firstly, given everything you've said, you know, given your kind of passion for people within ventures, why technology? What is it that draws you towards the technology ecosystem and businesses that operate within the technology sort of stack? Why those businesses, given you're so people orientated?
It's a funny one because, yeah, I did a fashion degree and I'm really not a fashion person. I suppose because actually for my age, I have the behaviour of a millennial. My father was a software developer, and to be Freudian, my husband is one too. But we had a Windows 95, Windows 3.1 at home when I was 16, 17. So I've sort of had that digital for quite a long time. I'm really passionate about technology taking away, you know, I'm not a big fan of robots taking over the world, but I am a big fan of robots giving us the capacity to do the great things and the lovely things that we are great as humans. I think implementation is a problem right now, but the boring tasks, you know, that we have, I'm sure you don't want to sit there doing a double ledger system with a pen and paper, you know, all of that stuff. This technology makes things possible. And I just, there's people at each end of that. And there's people, you know, input comes from a person, output goes to a person. And I think Microsoft is sort of typically, I think, on the spectrum, because Bill Gates, you know, there's some kind of non-empathetic people that seem to work there. And so sometimes they're washed aside. Technology is seen as this kind of, yeah, we don't need people, we've got technology. And I think actually, no. Our humanity is what means robots won't win, but also we're valuing the wrong thing. And I think if we take technology as an enabler and support factor, as opposed to the be all and end all, I think that flip would be great. I just think it has it just has the capacity to do so many good things. As I say, I think the implementation in what we think is important has possibly skewed versus what technology could go away and do.
Yeah, I am often fond of saying that I am incredibly enthusiastic about what technology could do for us. I'm just very disappointed in what we're doing with it at the moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Jelaine, it's been incredible talking to you. I would love to continue to dig into many, many more topics. I'm sure we could do that in the future. For the time being, where could our listeners find you? Where's the best place to look for you? Is that on Twitter, on LinkedIn? Where can they find you?
The best place is probably LinkedIn if you want to have a look at me. I am the only one on the internet, so if you get the spelling right, I'm on LinkedIn, or Google me. That's probably the best place. Yeah, I don't sit on that much social media, so that's the best place for me.
Obviously, a Microsoft product would be where you're at. With that, Jelaine, I really want to thank you for coming on and speaking to me today. It's been incredible. I think a lot of things that you said there have both resonated as well as given me pause for thought. One thing that you just said just at the end there, I'm going to take home and bank, you know, and that's input comes from a person, output goes to a person. I think that's an incredible way of thinking about technology and why it's valuable to us. So with that, have a great day, Jelaine. Thank you. And I look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you for having me. I'm always pleased to speak about stuff. So it's been great. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Nothing Ventured, an Emerge One production. As always, we'd love to get your feedback on our conversations, your thoughts, as well as topics or guests you'd love to hear from. Drop us a line on social media or via one of the links in the show notes. But for now, be well, and I hope to catch you on the next episode of Nothing Ventured. I mean, what have you got to lose, right?